It's to the best of our knowledge from PRX. I'm Anne Strainchamps. When did you first begin to notice, like really pay attention to bees?
So the first time that I was around a group of beehives up close was when I was probably around 8 years old.
This is writer Heather Swan.
My dad took me to visit a beekeeper. We walked into this room after looking at all of the beehives, and there were all of these frames filled with luminous honey, gorgeous honeycomb. Bees were flying everywhere, and there was this man who was just completely calm, extracting this incredible honey. And at that time, I just felt so overwhelmed by the magic of what the bee could do. Even more sort of magical was that a human being could be involved in this. There was a dream that I had. I was in a little plane, kind of like a Wright Brothers plane. My body was exposed and I was flying through these flowers. I was flying through big, huge cups of tulips and lilies and in and out and through the color. And I woke up. Oh my gosh. I just had a dream about what it would be like to be a honeybee.
Today, it's not just a dream. In the years since colony collapse disorder, and as bees have become more endangered, people all over the country, all over the world, have started trying to help by building beehives in their own backyards. Heather Swan is one of them. She's also a writer, and her bees have become a major inspiration. She's just written this beautiful book about them called Where Honeybees Thrive. And since she lives here in Madison, Steve Paulson asked if he could meet her and her bees. So you have to picture them sitting on her porch with her dog, 5 jars of honey, and a few flying friends.
I've had so many moments in my life where I realize when I look back now that I've been moving towards this. And then I heard someone say that beekeepers are chosen by bees. So then I had this fantasy, you know, could I please, you know, be chosen?
And what does that mean? The beekeeper sets up the hive. So how could the beekeeper be chosen by the bees?
I think that for me, it meant that I wanted to be accepted by the bees. There's an amazing thing that happened to me, actually. When I got my first package of bees, I drove in early spring in Wisconsin out into the sticks to this community where they had this big warehouse where they were delivering a bunch of bees. To get there, I was driving on these gravel roads that were full of ruts after winter. You know, it was just awful, just like terrible roads. And I got to this place and there was this big semi-truck full of packages of bees. And there was this man standing in there. It was a big, kind of a big burly lumberjack type of person with a plaid shirt on. And he handed me this box with screen all around the outside. And inside of that box was 10,000 bees.
Wow.
And I said to him, is there anything I should think about? This is my first box of bees. And he said, don't go over any bumps on the way home. And so I was terrified. I put them in my Jeep and I got into the car and I was thinking, okay, how many stings will it take to kill me? Will I be able to get out of the vehicle if we were to go over a bump and they were all to be released, what would happen? Anyway, so I put the bees on the floor of the car and I just sat there for a minute. And what was incredible was the sound the bees were making made me realize that I should just calm down. They were making this murmuring sound that reminded me very much of the experience of listening to monks when they're chanting. This was a real lesson for me. I needed to be reverent. I needed to respect them and understand that they knew what to do. They were okay. And I just needed to calm down and be peaceful and learn from them.
You're saying there's something sacred about this whole experience of being with bees.
For me, there is. And I'm sure there would be people who would think that was silly. For me, there is something sacred about being around bees.
What's so amazing about bees for you?
Well, when you see them in their community, which is this incredible architecture that they make out of wax, they can dance a map in the dark to a flower that might be a mile away from the hive, and the other bees will understand that. It's so miraculous, isn't it? It's so miraculous. I feel like we are so lucky to have this relationship with them. They cooperate, they're gentle to each other, they decide things democratically, which is kind of incredible because for so long we thought that the queen was in charge, but she's not.
You're almost describing a utopian community.
Yes, I think it is a utopian community.
Let's go look at your hive.
Okay.
Can we do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the things I've learned the hard way is that I really have to listen to the hive and sort of really respect their space and kind of get a read on how they're doing before I, you know.
You have to get a sense of the mood of the hive.
I do. It's a little bit sticky. Are you ready? Sometimes when they're flying really fast, they sound like zoom, like the, when they come past you. If they come by your ear, you'll probably notice. But these guys are all coming back from foraging. Ready? Okay. So what I did was I just tapped the edge of the frame onto the other frame. And what it did basically was just shake the bees all free. And so now they're more flying. Ready? Do it again.
Can I just say I'm impressed that you don't even have a glove on here and you're touching the bees. You're running your hand all over the bees.
Yes.
A lot of bees in
there. Very busy.
Wasn't there a time when you actually got quite badly stung by a lot of bees?
Bees don't want to sting you. They only do it when they're very desperate because they'll lose their life, right? Mm. If they sting you. And so there was a moment when I looked out at my hive and I saw that there was a lot of activity out there. And I thought to myself, oh, they don't have enough space. It's, you know, high summer. I need to just quickly put that other box on the top, that super, so that they have more space. And then they would settle down. And I was just really in a hurry. And I ran out, and when I got there, had I been paying attention, I would have realized that they were trying to fight off these other bees that were coming to steal the honey out of their hive. And so I wasn't really paying attention. I was moving really fast, and I pulled off this top box. And when I did, I dropped it on the ground. And, you know, there may have been 10,000 bees or something like that in there. Suddenly, they were all flying around. But the thing was that it was not only that I had dropped them, but also that they were dealing with this invasion. And so what I did was make them more vulnerable by opening up the hive, which was terrible. They were in a frenzy, just running into me and crashing into each other. I started getting stung again and stung again and stung again. At a certain point, I just put the lid back on the hive, and I just ran to my house. And I was so embarrassed, but also scared. Did I turn them against me? Have I lost their trust? And it took me a while, actually. But when I went the next time, I went with slowness, I went with mindfulness, and they were lovely to me. And I just feel like that was such a huge lesson to me, just about being mindful around them, for sure.
They're so beautiful.
It's sort of like, this looks like a work of art right here. Sort of on this frame, mm-hmm. bees climbing on top of other bees, these clusters of bees perched on their honeycombs.
Now, you mentioned that there's a lot of mistaken mythology about the queen. I mean, you know, the queen, everything sort of revolves around the queen, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there can't be a hive without the queen. All the bees there are to some degree to serve her. But yet, she's not really in charge of everything, is she?
Well, not in terms of making decisions. I mean, certainly she is clearly important. She's laying 2,000 eggs a day sometimes.
2,000 eggs a day?
Yeah, she's busy.
That's crazy.
Busy gal.
But she's also kind of trapped in the hive, isn't she? She has this job that she's got to just keep laying eggs, and sounds a little relentless, actually.
I love that you're advocating for her and thinking that maybe she needs a break. This is really good. Let's think about that more. Gee, should the queen be given a rest?
Look at you guys.
Can you see this in here? Those are little baby bees in there, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then so this is...
Oh, wow.
What they're doing is, up here, they're building the comb. What's incredible when you look at a magnification of a bee eye is that it actually looks a lot like honeycomb. It's made up of all of these incredible tiny lenses.
So you think the bees know you personally? I mean, they respond to you as an individual in a way that would be different from other people?
I would say that they probably are very familiar with my smell because they have such keen senses of smell. I feel like I know them, and I hope that they know me. I tell them things.
What do you tell them?
Well, there's this story that you should always tell the bees when big things are happening in your life, because if you don't, then they will be hurt. So I have a chair next to the beehive, and I sometimes whisper things to them, you know, like, I told them you were coming this morning, for instance.
I hope they responded favorably to that news.
They seemed very happy about it, yeah. Very peaceful. Having a relationship with any animal is really profound often. But having a relationship with insects is just so rare.
Well, thank you. This has been such a treat to look into your hive.
Thank you. Now, so do you want to taste a little honey?
I would love.
Okay, let's do that.
What's your dog's name?
My dog's name is Shino. He's a German Shepherd and Boxer mix. Yeah. He's okay with the bees. He usually keeps his distance. So what I have for you is honey from the hive that you just visited. See how clear that is? That's the honey from this summer. The bees that you just visited, they made this. Whoop. Oh, goodness, see, we have bees coming already to join.
The bees want to do the taste testing.
Yeah,
too.
They do. It's like a little potluck.
It is amazing.
I mean, it's like when you taste it, you realize why honey has been in all kinds of sacred ceremonies all over the world for centuries. Can you taste the flowers on your tongue?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
My bees are doing really well. But it's because we have this amazing diversity of flowers here, and it just happens to be this.
Later, I was going to say maybe it's because they're happy here.
Oh, it might be. Oh, look at this little tiny baby. Hi. I have to rescue this bee.
So the bee just climbed right into the honey dish.
She'll be okay.
And so she's sitting on your finger now.
She's totally sticky. Poor dear. Oh, my goodness sakes. Yeah, this is a bumblebee.
Oh, wow.
Look at that.
So this is not one of your bees, because you don't have bumblebees.
No, this is a bumblebee. And, I'm so sorry, sweetie. I know it. See, she'll just have to clean herself off there.
Yeah, well, that's all right.
No, she's okay.
I just heard that there's actually one species of bumblebee that's just been put on the endangered species list.
Yeah, that's right. The rusty-patched bumblebee.
Wow. We should talk about that for a moment. I mean, we haven't talked about the threats to bees. And mm-hmm. I mean, we heard about it 10 years ago. We heard a lot about colony collapse disorder, that suddenly there were vast populations of bees that were dying off. Mm-hmm. Is that still a big problem?
It is still a big problem. There's a lot of work being done on the reduction of insects worldwide. And Germany had this amazing study that showed that the flying insect population had decreased by 75% in 25 years, which is...
All flying insects.
Yeah. That's a devastating number. And when you think about how crucial insects are in our ecosystem, we don't think about insects. We don't see them. In fact, mostly we try to get rid of them. And the problem is that we've been so successful at designing chemicals that will kill them that we're now facing a different problem, which is the disappearance. And so it's not just honeybees. It's all of the wild bees. It's all of the pollinators.
This is mainly because of pesticides?
It's a constellation of problems. One really big problem is that there's a lack of food for the insects. You know, with development and monoculture, one place that I say that individuals can really make a difference is just in their own yards. Plant flowers that are native to your area and stop pouring so many chemicals on your lawn. And just that alone would be a huge step in the right direction. Oh, we have another bee. Yeah,
another bee that got stuck in the honey there. Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's Heather Swan, author of Where Honeybees Thrive, talking with Steve Paulson. By the way, we posted some pictures online, so if you want to see producer Mark Rickers valiantly sticking a microphone in a buzzing hive, you can find them at ttbook.org.
Dipping into the flower zone, honey stomach plump with nectar, soaking up directions, finding our ways in the dark. Fat little pollen baskets plumping our legs. You had no idea, did you? You kept talking about that wheelbarrow and chicken. Round dance, waggle dance. Only 5 species of honeybee among 20,000 different bee species. Out there in the far field, something has changed, but you don't know what it is yet. And everything depends on us.
That's Honeybee by Naomi Shihab Nye, read by Stephanie Elkins. So yes, bees are magical and mystical, and they are also utterly essential. I mean, do you like to eat?
Every almond that you eat had to have been pollinated by a bee. Since colony collapse disorder, there haven't been enough honeybees to go around. It has caused the occurrence of bona fide bee rustlers, people who come in the dead of night and steal honeybee hives from these orchards in the almond groves of Central California. There was a sting operation. The authorities caught some bee rustlers who had contraband bees, all these hives that they had stolen that were valued at close to $1 million.
Hunting for missing bees, next. I'm Ann Strangchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. When we talk about bees, usually we mean honeybees or maybe bumblebees. But that's just 2. You know how many different kinds of bees there are in the world? 20,000. I mean, that's more species than all the birds and all the mammals put together. Conservation biologist Thor Hansen dreams of one day seeing them all. And if you're thinking that maybe sounds a little bit dull,
no, bees can be just as colorful as anything in your bird book. You can have bees that have red hairs or shiny red bodies. You can have bees with fuzzy blue hairs like the carpenter bees of Indonesia. One of my favorites is something called the alkali bee, which has these stripes that, if you look closely, are shimmering with rainbows because the structure of that surface of the bee scatters light just like the surface of an opal.
Is that the one that you wrote about? You said it looks as if it's made of light?
It does look that way. You can hardly focus your eyes on those colors. They just seem to shift and move as if the bee were made from light itself.
Oh, that's just magical.
These little flying jewels that surround us, we just need to slow down and pay attention to them.
Bees must go way, way, way back for that many different kinds to have evolved.
All the way to the age of the dinosaurs, the mid-Cretaceous period, about 120 million years ago. Bees evolved from wasps. There had been wasps around for millions of years. But the wasps are inherently hunters and scavengers. They're constantly scouring the landscape for other insects or spiders or scavenging bits of meat.
So they're carnivorous.
They are carnivores at heart. Bees evolved from the wasps by developing a dietary habit. They became vegetarians, provisioning themselves solely from the products of flowers.
We should call them floritarians.
Well, a good way, a silly but good way, honestly, to think of the evolution of bees and to remember all the key steps is to think of them as hippie wasps.
Flower children.
They are the flower children of the wasp tribe, if you will, in that they are long-haired flower lovers.
120 million years ago means that bees are actually older than humans, which means humans must have evolved right along with bees. Did they interact much?
This is a wonderful question, and it goes straight to the heart of some new research that is fascinating to me. And that is, if you look at the hunter-gatherer people living in East Africa, particularly the Hadza tribe, you find that they are incredible honey hunters, scouring the landscape, the savanna, for bee nests and beehives. But it wasn't until quite recently that anthropologists decided to ask the question, well, how much honey do these people eat? And they found that it was a full 15% of the Hadza diet.
That's a lot.
It is a lot of honey, those calories all coming from honey. And it becomes particularly interesting in an evolutionary context.
How come?
Well, because the story of human evolution has always been a story about brain size. And the brain is what physiologists like to call metabolically expensive. It takes a lot of energy to run the brain.
Is that because it's big compared to so many other species' brains?
It's because it is metabolically active. Before your cup of coffee in the morning, your brain is busy and taking up a lot of energy. And so to evolve a larger brain, you need to be able to fuel it. So what's interesting about this honey hunting example is that anthropologists are now asking, well, would our ancestors have done anything else? They would have loved honey too and would have been subsisting in the same area, doing basically the same thing. No one's saying, I should say, that honey made us human, but that it could have contributed to the increases in brain size over our evolutionary history.
So when people talk about the decline in the bee population these days, there's a term for it, right? The beepocalypse. And it goes with this really scary scenario that the bees are dying or going extinct. And that means the world's crop supply is going to crumble and eventually humans will starve to death. Is that just dystopian fantasy or is that really likely to happen?
Well, this idea of the beepocalypse has definitely caught our imagination, in part because we're so dependent upon bees for so much of our food supply. I mean, people often say that every third bite of food is reliant in one way or another on bees. But there is some good news from all the research that's gone on, and the good news is this. We know enough to take action. So we do now see some encouraging signs where people are trying to bring flowers back into rural landscapes that have lost them or planting bee gardens in backyards and even in urban areas. And we see that bees do respond to restoration efforts. And that is perhaps the most encouraging thing.
You tell this wonderful story about a small community in rural Washington that's kind of modeling what a truly pro-bee lifestyle might look like. Can you tell us about that?
The town is Touche, Washington. It's in the dry eastern part of the state, and they have a tradition of growing alfalfa for seed, and you cannot make alfalfa seed without bees. But what's peculiar about alfalfa flowers is that the flower parts are packed together so tightly in the petals at the center of the flower, that when the bee comes in to access that pollen and reach the nectar, the flower parts bonk the bee right on the head. And honeybees can't stand it. They won't put up with it. So they're crummy pollinators for alfalfa. So the farmers in this rural community noticed generations ago that there was a little bee accessing their alfalfa fields just from the habitat surrounding them. And these little bees didn't mind getting bonked on the head at all. In fact, they seemed to thrive on this alfalfa pollen and nectar. And so they followed the bees back to where they were naturally nesting, and they found them along the edge of the river in these sort of salt pan areas. These were a species of bee called the alkali bee. And in fact, they're a bee that we mentioned earlier in the interview with these shimmering, pearly, opalescent stripes. They're just a gorgeous little bee.
The ones that look like flying light.
The ones that look like flying light, these little jewels. And they followed them home, and they found that the bees were nesting underneath these salt crusts in these flat areas. So they came back to their farms, and they decided that, well, we can make that habitat right here next to our alfalfa fields. It is probably the only place in the world where you can find farmers purposely salting their fields. They go out with thousands of pounds of rock salt and cover the ground in bee beds next to the alfalfa fields. And the last time anyone bothered to count, there were an estimated 18 to 25 million female alkali bees nesting in those bee beds alongside the alfalfa. It's the largest aggregation of native bees measured any place.
And you wrote that it's not just the farmers, it's like the whole community is really aware of how dependent they are on bees. You wrote that during droughts, people will skip showers and let their lawns die just to keep the water for the bees.
Isn't that marvelous? But it's true. The whole community now understands how important those bees are to the local economy, to the point where the road department is involved. You drive into that valley and you come up next to an alfalfa field, and here's a road sign that drops the speed limit from 50 miles an hour down to 20. And right underneath that sign is a very standard road sign that says alkali bee area.
It's a bee safe zone.
Yeah, it is a bee speed zone.
Wow.
I mean, you drive slow in Tushy to save the bees.
I really love that. So my question is, is that kind of thing, people coming together to support this tiny insect, is that happening in other ways in other places? I mean, would you say that we're seeing a kind of renaissance of people reaffirming their connections to bees?
I like to think it's beginning. And I like the fact that you say renaissance, because I really believe that in learning about bees, we are also undergoing an act of remembrance. Because we have this ancient, ancient connection to bees, it's really only over the past few generations that we have become distanced from them.
Has working with bees affected you at all emotionally, personally?
Well, I mentioned earlier that I have always looked for ways to chase after these creatures in daily life. And I would say that they have become a part of the rhythm of life for me and really in my family, in that we look for bees. We notice them now in ways that we didn't used to. And seeing the first bumblebee of the season is a big event for us. It's a symbol of that rebirth and the springtime where we might have once listened for the birds singing. Now the bees are a part of it, and I think we can all participate in that rhythm.
Thor Hansen is a conservation biologist and the author of Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. So next, we've got the story of urban big city bees. And for that, we're going to go to Detroit. Timothy Paul and Nicole Lindsay live there. And a couple of years ago, they started buying up empty, abandoned lots and building beehives on them. They told producer Shannon Henry Kleiber that their first was a 3,500-square-foot parcel, and they bought it for $340.
Well, we Googled it on Google at first. It was 9336 East Warren. Yeah. And it just looked like it was some overgrown grass with some wild weeds. So it was like, you know, we can just take over this property. It doesn't look too bad. We can cut the grass and, you know, start our bee farm. It wasn't until we actually started working on the lot that we discovered the hidden treasure underneath. And the hidden treasure I'm referring to is mattresses, tires, 10 years worth of trash, Dorito chips, bricks, glass bottles, all types of buried treasures.
How did you get this idea? Were you walking by a vacant lot and thought something should be done with that? Or were you really interested in bees? How did this come about?
Great question. In December 2016, I was overtaken by a cold that I could not get rid of. I was trying all types of home remedies. See, I come from a background where my grandmother always created these home concoctions. So I tried garlic, onions, turmeric, and nothing worked. 2 months had began to go by. My cough was really hurting really bad. It was hurting the whole side of my lungs until I came across a local store in Ferndale, Michigan. And I was going in there just to probably grab some chips and juice until the store owner recognized that I had a really bad cough. And he had this really golden voice. He said, "Yo, man, you need to try our local raw honey." And so I laughed at him and he said, "You know, no, you need to really try it. I get it from a farm up here in Michigan. I know the beekeeper is local, is raw, it's medicinal."
What did it taste like?
It was very delicious. So I was consuming this honey morning, noon, and night. I noticed that my cough began to suppress. I no longer had that really hard, dry cough.
So how did you go from being a consumer of honey to saying, well, we want to change downtown Detroit and make urban bee farms?
So me and Timothy are both native Detroiters, born and raised, and we have been here. We've seen the decline in our city, and we wanted to purchase vacant lots and transform them into something, wanted to activate that space.
So take me on a kind of visual tour of your lot there. How many hives do you have, and what's happening? What's going on?
So when you visit Detroit Hives, our East Warren apiary, you're going to find a beautiful painted mural, and that was done by the people of the community. And then when you walk in, you're going to see an array of 10 hives. Here at Detroit Hives, we do believe in bee diversity. There are over 450 native bees in Michigan. You know, honeybees aren't native to the United States. They've been brought over. So we do want to support and save our native bees as well. So we create pollinator habitats where we allow the wild plants and wildflowers to grow on a selected piece of land where we can have visiting butterflies, visiting monarchs, hummingbirds, bumblebees, and native bees to visit this area and to find some great sources for pollen and nectar.
What's your relationship to these bees?
Relationship?
Yeah. We're bee parents.
We're bee parents.
You know, Nicole and I don't have any kids yet. Yeah. So these bees are serving as our children. We have like over thousands and thousands and thousands of children now.
Right.
Wow.
Like any other like parent, when you get a new child, you become very overprotective. You want to be with them all day, every day.
Check on them.
Check on them multiple times.
That sounds so sweet.
We're just excited.
And this is something that Nicole and I never had any prior background into.
Nothing.
And to fact, Nicole and I were both afraid of bees and never really were outdoorsy people.
You were both afraid of bees before
absolutely.
You started this?
Yes, we didn't
absolutely.
Know the difference between bees and wasps.
Are you still afraid in any way?
Oh, absolutely
no, that fear
not.
Is gone. You know,
it's gone.
It went from fear to love.
What do the neighbors say? Are the neighbors like, what are those people doing over there with the bees? Are they happy that you're there?
The neighbors love it. For one, it's been blighted for over 10 years. It was always viewed as an eyesore. We believe the first thing you see outside your door is a direct reflection of who you are. But when you see people in the community that look like you, that's from the community, picking up their own trash, inspires people to clean up their act. And a lot of these people in this community, they have to travel sometimes 30 minutes just to get to a healthy organic grocery store. Now they have a honeybee farm that they can walk to.
Yeah, and they're able to see how honey is made.
Nicole, what's your favorite part of being a beekeeper?
My favorite part about being a beekeeper is being able to educate children all about bees, particularly young girls. Because I have a lot of girls who visit the farm who may be afraid of all types of insects, bugs. I want to expose them to something different. I want them to be able to see a girl or a woman like me doing something different out of the norm that you wouldn't typically see. And then they're also seeing us come within our own community and transforming you know, we're fixing a problem and providing a solution within our own community.
It's kind of like you're trying to save the bees, but you're also trying to save your city, too.
Absolutely. Exactly. Improving the quality of life, not only for the community, but also for its pollinators and plants.
Timothy Paul and Nicole Lindsay are the creators of Detroit Hives, and they were talking with Shannon Henry Cliver. And now, how about another bee poem?
The beekeepers have gathered at the city's edge, selling their wares from the backs of trucks and makeshift tables. The women have wrapped flowered aprons around their sturdy waists. With a palette knife in his brown hands, a man scoops waxy honey into jars. They are even selling bee stings to ease arthritis or whatever else ails you. Sit down with the old man who has piercing blue wisdom in his eyes. He'll hold your bared arm gently on the upturned crate. The bees are waiting.
That's Medicine by Corinna Borowitz, read by Peter Sobel. So coming up, how smart are bees? You would be surprised. Very surprised. I'm Anne Strandchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Every couple of months, it seems like, there's some startling new discovery about bee intelligence. Like just recently, researchers proved that bees understand the concept of zero as a numerical value, and even young children have trouble with that. Well, for Christoph Koch, a neuroscientist in the field of consciousness, the moral is never underestimate the intelligence of another species, especially bees.
They do very complicated things. We know that individual bees can fly mazes. They can remember scents. They can return to a distant flower, right? In fact, they can communicate with each other. So they can communicate the best source, location, and quality of a distant food source.
And they do this through their waggle dance, right?
Correct. They do that through a dance. They can respond to individual faces. They have facial recognition. They can learn.
Wait, individual bee faces?
No, individual faces of, for example, their beekeeper.
Oh, human faces?
Yes. Evidence has shown that. And certainly they can recognize their beekeeper. So under normal condition, they would never sting their beekeeper because they've recognized them, probably a combination of visual and olfactory cues. Their brain contains roughly 1 million neurons. Comparison, our brain contains roughly 100 billion, so 100,000 times more. Yet the complexity of their brain is staggering. And per unit volume, their brain is obviously much less. I mean, it's smaller than a piece of quinoa. But the complexity staggering is 10 times higher in terms of the density of our cortex. They have all the complicated components that we have in our brains, but in a smaller package. So there's no reason to presuppose there's something radical different about them. So yes, I do believe, and I try not to kill bees or other wasps or other insects anymore, that it feels like something to be a honeybee, and it probably feels very good to be dancing in the sunlight and feels very good to have access to some nectar and to be able to drink that and carry that back to their hive.
So you're talking about the consciousness of an individual bee, not just the hive, because, you know, we sort of have the sense of, oh, the hive has this complexity and it's sort of like an organism in itself. You're talking about individual bees here.
I'm talking about the potential for sentience in individual bees. That's correct, because a priori, there's no reason to exclude them. Why? Because they can't talk. Well, lots of people can't talk. Babies can't talk. Patients can't talk. That's rather arbitrary. Because they don't have a human brain, well, that's completely arbitrary. Right? So it's very difficult on any fundamental grounds to presuppose that they are totally different from us. And of course, they share a lot of the basic metabolism, a lot of the basic machinery of the brain. They share with us. They have action potential. They have neurons. They have ionic channels. They have neurotransmitter. They have dopamine, just like we have. They have some of the same reward circuitry that we have. Yes, they evolved from us 250 million years ago or something like that, but still we evolved with a similar infrastructure.
So brain size is not the be-all and end-all here of consciousness.
That's entirely correct. There's no principal reason to assume that brain size should be the be-all and end-all.
I assume the pun was unintended. Neuroscientist Christoph Koch. So you know that waggle dance that he and Steve just mentioned? That dance that a bee does to show the rest of the hive where to find a new food source. Well, that was discovered by another German scientist. His name was Carl von Frisch. He later won a Nobel Prize for the discovery. And Frisch had a lot of reasons to be grateful to bees. He was targeted by the Nazis during World War II and denounced for having Jewish ancestry, but it was his work on bees that saved his career. Steve's been reading Tanya Munz's biography of von Frisch, and she says he began by discovering that bees can see different colors.
They are able to see ultraviolet light. They're able to see polarized light. So they have a different sensibility about the natural world around them. And that's really what Carl von Frisch was exploring. He was really trying to figure out how do bees see their world.
And didn't he also figure out some things about where bees actually have their receptors on their body to detect smell and even sort of the sense of space, too?
Yes. And in fact, he realized that those senses were co-located. So in a way, they would be able to smell space. So it's a very different sensory apparatus.
What does that mean, to smell space?
That the receptors of space have a co-located receptor of odor. So we can't really answer that. I mean, I can't translate that for you.
I mean, it's just, it's this whole different way of perceiving the world, I guess.
Yes.
Wow. So the discovery that really put him on the map was figuring out how honeybees communicate with each other, specifically through this elaborate dance that has been called the waggle dance. And people had seen this for centuries. I mean, people knew that bees do this dance, but they never knew why. And then he comes along and figures it out.
Yes. So Aristotle had written about how the bees shake, and he basically described the honeybee dances. And beekeepers also for centuries had speculated about bees recruiting one another to food sources. So Carl von Frisch noticed that when a dish was empty where a bee had previously been feeding, that a bee might come back now and again to check on this food dish. When he filled it up, he realized that lots of bees appear very quickly.
He figured out that these bees were telling the other bees, oh, come and check it out.
Exactly. And then when he looked into the hive, he discovered that the bees seem to perform these kinds of dances. And the waggle dance is in the shape of a figure eight. And over the course of von Frisch's research, he surmised that bees with the waggle dance were able to indicate the distance and direction of food sources. They're actually indicating via their dances how far away they should be searching for foods. Mm.
So let me see if I understand this. So an individual bee might go off maybe for miles from the hive looking for food sources, will find something delicious, then will come back to the hive and will have to tell the other bees, hey, this is what I found, and get them to follow. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. When you think about a figure eight that's sort of smushed in the middle where there's kind of a straight portion between the two half circles, the straight run portion of that figure eight, the bee transposed in the hive by the same angle as she flew out to that food source with respect to the sun. So the straight run portion tells the other bees what direction from the sun they should be flying in, and the frequency with which the bees dances her figure eight tells them how far away. So the farther away, the more sluggish the bee dances, the closer, the faster she dances.
Wow. How did he figure this out?
So Carl von Frisch had a very simple technique by which he was able to keep track of individual bees. He painted little dots on the thoracic and abdominal sections of the bees' bodies to indicate decimal space.
Wait, wait. He got out a paintbrush and he painted dots on individual bees. So somehow he had to slow them down and, you know, I don't know, anesthetize them in some way.
Not anesthetize him. He actually, in his books, he shows he uses these kind of like mesh pincers to carefully hold the bee in place. And then with a very steady hand, make a little colored dot onto the body of the bee to number it.
So this is really an amazing means of communication, which
I don't know if it had ever been discovered before in the animal world. I mean, such precise directions on where to go.
This finding on honeybees really was considered a sensation. I mean, this discovery that an animal as lowly as a honeybee would possess something that seemed like symbolic communication really captured the attention of lots of different people in lots of different disciplines. This was a big deal. And then by the 1960s, the honeybees had emerged as the most common form of non-human communication that was studied.
Right. So Carl von Frisch had made this amazing discovery. He built up quite a name for himself, especially in German science. But then there's another story, a sort of a parallel story to all of this. He ran into trouble when the Nazis came to power in 1933. What happened?
One of the first things that the Nazis did after Hitler was chancellor was to have all civil servants fill out papers to prove that they were Aryan, that their ancestry was properly Aryan according to their standards. And Carl von Frisch filled out his papers in 1933 and indicated that his parents and grandparents were all Roman Catholic. But over the years, in the 30s, denunciations against von Frisch start to accumulate. And of course, this was a period when there were many denunciations and really nobody was safe. And then in late 1940, the Nazi government actually finds evidence that his maternal grandmother, in fact, was Jewish and that her parents converted to Catholicism shortly before she was born. So as part of many people in the 19th century, as they became assimilated and they became part of the bourgeoisie, would convert to Catholicism or to Christianity. And so in early 1941, Carl von Frisch gets a letter from the university that says, we will force you into retirement because according to the 1937 law, you are no longer eligible to teach and you have been found to be a quarter Jewish.
Wasn't there a phrase, you are a second degree crossbreed?
Yes, exactly. So this kind of chilling accounting that was done by the Nazis when one grandparent was Jewish, the classification was second degree crossbreed.
Well, the way you write about this, too, I mean, it's sort of fascinating how this happened because, I mean, he enlisted various prominent German scientists to come to his defense, and they did. But that wasn't enough. Then there was a bee plague that broke out, threatening to wipe out Germany's bees. And actually, the president of the South Bavarian Beekeepers Association came out to his defense, appealed directly to the Nazi headquarters to save his job.
And the reason being that there's a bee plague, it's called Nosema apis, it's a microsporidium that infects bees and it flares up at certain times. And it was, at that time, devastating Central European bee populations. And because food was so important in World War II, and in fact, a lot of how Germany interpreted its loss in World War I was because of food shortages. And here they were again, locked into this grinding war of attrition, and they needed to feed the troops, they needed to feed the home front, and von Frisch's work on this bee plague promised to help alleviate food shortages.
Hmm. So for very practical reasons, he was kept on the job to help fight this plague.
Very much so.
Do we know what Carl von Frisch actually thought about the Nazis, and specifically their efforts to purge Jews from the academy?
You know, I spent so many years, about 10 years in his letters and archives. But he's somebody who was actually very reserved. I actually very rarely caught glimpses of his sort of more emotional life. There are some indications, though. I know that he very much bridled at the fact that the Nazis told him who he could and couldn't hire. He kept in touch with his students after they left. He put in a good word for scientists in Poland after they were all arrested and interned in the Dachau concentration camp. So he was no friend of the regimes, but he wasn't a full-out active resistor either. And I think in some ways, that's what makes his story so challenging, but it's also a part that makes it really worth paying attention to.
That's Tanya Munz talking with Steve Paulson. Her biography of Carl von Frisch is called The Dancing Bees. So one of the most remarkable things about this hour, to me, is how many people love bees. I can't think of another insect that inspires so much wonder, curiosity, reverence.
Emily Dickinson wrote a poem that says it all. It goes like this. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. One clover and a bee. And reverie. The reverie alone will do if bees are few. Thanks for being with us this hour. And now that you're done listening, be sure to check out the expanded features on our website. We posted pictures of Steve and crew visiting Heather Swan's beehives. There are pictures from the Detroit hives. And this week's newsletter includes a story Shannon wrote about the extraordinary relationship between elephants and bees. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin, by the hive mind of Charles Monroe Kane, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Halima Shah, and Mark Rickers. Our technical director, who never met a buzz he didn't like, is Joe Hartke. Steve Paulson is our buzzworthy executive producer. And, I'm sorry this will stop soon, I'm the Queen Bee, Anne Strangechamps.